Reiki Answer Lady podcast, where we explore complementary and alternative therapies and how those therapies can positively impact your Reiki business, your Reiki practice, and your personal health and well-being. You can find a wealth of information on all aspects of Reiki on our website, www.ReikiAnswerLady.com. Be sure to visit and sign up for our newsletter. I hope that you enjoy today's show. And welcome to the Reiki Answer Lady podcast. This is your hostess, Carmen Tracy, and today I'm here with Franstina, who is the main teacher from the International House of Reiki, and he's also an author of The Inner Heart of Reiki, Rediscovering Your True Self. Welcome, Franz.
Welcome. Thank you, Carmen, for inviting me.
Thank you for being a guest on my show. I'm really excited. I have watched a lot of your videos, in particular the toning videos, and I was hoping that we would have opportunity to talk about that. But first, you know, I wanted to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself and the International House of Reiki.
Ooh, okay. Well, yeah, I'm originally from the Netherlands, and but I've been in Australia for the last 18 years, but I teach worldwide. I teach a lot in the US, in Europe, in Australia. I recently was in New Zealand for the first time, what is great.
Oh, wow.
And so I've been teaching full-time for the last 20 years.
Wow.
And it's I don't like saying it is my work because I don't really see it as work. It's my hobby. It's my life. For me, the system of Reiki is really a life style, you know, and from that the teaching flows. I wrote some books together with my partner Bronwyn, and The Inner Heart of Reiki was my first book, what I wrote by myself, and that came out last year, which is great.
Yes.
And really excited about it.
Yes. Well, so, you know, your path with Reiki has been, you know, I'm not sure if it's just because you have access to more international type information in Australia or not, but it seems like you have taken a very specific approach to the way that you teach Reiki to other people and the way that you learn Reiki too, because I know you are always going to Japan for further training for yourself personally. So how do you think that came about? Was that just like your access to information, or was that like your first teacher, or how did all that work out for you?
Well, actually, my first teacher was, I was living in India and Nepal at that time for 2 years. And my first teacher was an English guy who was a hippie who was smoking pot, while he was teaching.
That's hilarious.
And it was very so-so. But it worked for me, you know. I really, and what was interesting at that time, because I was just traveling around, I was 30, and I had a lot of time on my hands. So I remember sitting in Kathmandu, Nepal, in a beautiful area where they have these stupas, and I was meditating on the symbols and the mantras. You know, I was not doing anything specific, but just meditating upon it. And because I had so much time on my hand at that time, I was doing a lot of this kind of playing around with it. And he never had taught me these kind of things, but I was just trying to investigate what does it mean, blah, blah, blah. And then I started to have very strange dreams. And at that time, we moved to Darjeeling in India. And these dreams kind of continued, and because it was all very new for me. And then I made a friend there who I talked to. He was a Buddhist. And I said, oh, you know, I've got all these strange dreams.
Yeah.
And I explained it to me. And he said, are you practicing Buddhism? And I said, no. And he said, because these dreams are what my teacher would look for if a person is going through a lot of purification and those kind of things. And I go, oh, he said, these are really specific Buddhist dreams. And I go, well, I'm not sure. I just, where the system of Reiki really comes from.
Yeah.
So that was one trigger where I wanted to know where the system of Reiki came from.
Yeah.
And then another thing was that in Darjeeling and around it, there's a lot of healers. And they are Tibetan, Nepali, shamanistic, Buddhist, all sorts of, you know, Hindu. And when I talked to these people, all of them had a very strong meditation practice.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, why don't we have that in the system of Reiki? And I remember I met this young Tibetan Lama. It was a tulku, a reincarnated Lama. He was in his 21. And we were chatting, and he said, oh, what is Reiki then? You know, he was staying in the same little guest house. The guest house had only like 4 or 5 rooms.
Yeah.
And so I explained to him, and he goes with his hand like this, and he goes, oh, like this. And the energy and the heat what came from this guy, I was going, yeah, something like this. And he just came out of a meditation retreat with his teacher where he'd spent 9 months in a cave. And so I started to wonder, and then I started to, you know, read up more about Miku Sui, and that he spent 21 days meditating on a mountaintop. And then I saw that Mrs. Takada actually in a diary wrote that Reiki comes from at the bottom of your stomach, and that true meditation, it has to come out.
Yeah.
And I thought, why isn't this, no one is teaching me this? So I started to really investigate. So the first thing I did was really investigating some more Western teachers and did more training with them. And then I started to do training with Yakuji Inamoto, Hiroshi Doi. I was still not really finding what I was looking for. Then I did a training with Chris Maas, and then that brought me already more closer. And then I started to work more with Japanese priests.
Okay.
And who were really pointing out to me what Miku Sui really might have practiced himself at that time.
Right.
You know, where do these symbols and mantras come from? Where does the Reiju come from, or the attunement or initiation?
So like
all
the
of these.
Shingendo and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Sure.
And it's really fascinating, you know, to see the heritage of all of that and how Miku Sui, therefore, also was seen as a, we might, between brackets, a healer. Because for me, really, what I was seeing was that in the time of Miku Sui, and before that, there weren't many doctors. So people who were sick, they would go to these healers. They would go to the priests or the nuns, you know, for healing to take place. And those priests and nuns had spiritual practices to lay bare that innate healing power within themselves. And so therefore you see actually a lot of traces of like Chokurei, for example, in other spiritual teachings in Japan, or the Reiki 3 symbol and mantra, for example, you can see traces of that. Or so if we therefore look correctly, and I think that's been really my journey, to come back to your question.
Yes.
I'm kind of going like
no,
this.
No, I love it. Thank you.
That really instigated these kind of experiences I had in India, instigated my search of where did the system of Reiki came from? What was Miku Sui himself practicing? Mm-hmm. Because as we all know, we can all go to the movies, Carmen, with 10 people. And after we've gone to the movies, and at the end, we might all have a different idea about what the movie was about,
yes,
right?
Right. Yep.
And this is the same thing. We all might go to a teacher, and he or she might give a talk, and we might pick up this bit. Another person might pick up that bit.
Yes.
And then suddenly, it's already different.
Right, right. Right, and then they take that back to where they're going and, you know, add
That's
their
it.
Life experiences.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that one is wrong or one is right. We're all right.
Right, right.
But, you know, we also all therefore have for ourselves, some people I see just want to do some basic hands-on healing. What is wonderful? Some people want to have a real spiritual practice. What is also wonderful? And some people want to linger in the middle. What is also wonderful?
Right.
And I think Miku Sui is very clever to offer that, like hands-on healing, just basic hands-on healing, to a really deep spiritual practice and everything in between.
Yes.
And depending on the student, really supplying him or her with those tools.
Okay. Now, what is the Is your school, so the International House of Reiki, do you have a space where you bring your students together and you practice like meditation together out of there? Or have you kind of adopted sort of like the rest of us, other places to teach and other people gather and then, you know, have opportunities online to connect with you on like more of a regular basis?
I have all of them.
Yay.
So I'm sitting in my Reiki studio now. It's just about an hour and a half, 2 hours from Sydney. It's in the Blue Mountains, what is really beautiful. It's on a 5-acre. And we do some retreats there. I do my Reiki 1 and Reiki 2 and Reiki 3 classes here. I'm actually just organizing a sound healing workshop for a day where we look at Japanese mantras and sounds for healing.
Great.
When I travel, I often try to go back to the same places because then, you know, we can come together as a group again. And then I offer a lot of online support. So I do a lot of live video teleclasses. I just did one on Reiki and intimacy. There will be one on Reiki in Japan in October. People can contact me for Skype sessions. So for me, you know, I really see it that when we've done Reiki 1, like say we do a class, maybe a 2-day class or a 5-day class, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That's not the end. Actually, that is the beginning, you know?
Yes.
And that's the same with Reiki 2. That's not the end. That's the beginning. And it's the same with Reiki 3. For me, it's really a lifelong journey. And hopefully, you know, we can hold each other's hands and walk that path together in that space of healing and supporting each other. As I don't really see it even as, I don't call myself a Reiki master. I rather call myself a Reiki teacher. And then I don't even really see it as teacher-student, but I see it more as over time we become friends and holding hands together, supporting each other in that spiritual journey, you know, and trying to rediscover this great bright light hidden within ourselves.
Right. Oh, that's beautiful. Now, when your students are interested in learning more of the deeper level Japanese meditations, is that part of what you teach? Is that like an inherent part of your 1, 2, and 3 classes, or do you offer like extra intensives?
I do both. So it is kind of interwoven in our classes, but of course, even if we have a month's class, we still, you know, it's only still the beginning. So the student really has to take that practice and apply it on a regular daily basis for themselves. And so I kind of see that I have two parallel teachings in a way where we do the classes and then from the classes, some people might just say, oh, I just do some nice hands-on healing or meditate a little bit on a symbol. Yeah. Some other might say, well, I'm going to every day do meditation and chanting of the mantras. And so from that, then I always say it's up to you to reconnect with me. I cannot always connect to everybody. I mean, you know, you have thousands of students. It's difficult. So then for the people who connect back to me, then we can really then monitor and say, how are you going? And they might say, oh, I'm going, okay, this and this is happening. And then I might say, okay, now try it on this way or maybe add this to it. Right. So then slowly, you know, helping them with that growth and a deeper practice. But I always say, you know, you can take a horse to the water, but you can't make a drink.
Right, of course. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I had on a woman who learned from Mrs. Takata, and I was kind of comparing all the stuff that I learned versus like what she had learned, you know, from somebody like that. And, you know, I was taught a meditation. I was taught to use the ideals as a meditation, really. And in fact, my teacher taught them in Japanese, you know, and I don't know how accurate that, you know, the Japanese translation was necessarily, but it added an element to my practice that felt very spiritual. And it felt very like, actually, it did help a lot because I started to notice more things in the way that I was acting in community. But that wasn't something that Mrs. Takata taught, per se. So,
well, I mean, I think also, if I really look at Mrs. Takata's teachings, I can also see that she was teaching different people different things.
Ah, okay. All right, that makes sense.
And so again, therefore, you know, it's so, therefore I think we cannot really say this is Mikasui's teachings, because if we look at maybe 10 students of Mikasui, we might see 10 slightly different things. And even when I go to Japan, my teachers teach the same, you know, they really teach on a very individual basis on what they feel you really need, what they feel you're gravitating to. And, you know, for example, when we look at Mikasui's teachings, we see the precepts, what can be very intellectual, so we can think about it.
Right.
Hands-on healing, very tactile. Yep. Mantras, more verbal.
Yep.
Symbols, more visual. And as we know, you know, we all learn in different ways. The other day, my daughter had a book and said, "Oh, Dad, this is a great passage. I'll read it for you." And she read it, and I go like, okay, but now I need to read it myself, right?
Right.
And because that's how I learn.
Yeah.
And so we also have very different ways of learning that. And I think this is why, you know, when a lot of people debate, oh, this is the true Mikasui's teachings or blah, blah, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, really, where it comes down to is your direct experience.
Yeah.
And the most important is the direct experience of the precepts in your daily life.
Yeah. Well, I like that. It kind of gives us a little bit of break too, as a, you know, as a person on what I consider, I like the spiritual part of Reiki. So I consider myself, you know, on a spiritual path with Reiki.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so for me, that kind of makes me feel like I can cut myself some slack.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
And just
let
Reiki guide me too, right? Because it continues to bring in experiences and people into my life. And then, you know, if they want to learn things with me, then I can share, hey, this is how this worked for me.
Yeah.
Why don't you give it a try?
I mean, and this is also why there is no competition, because people will be attracted to different people, right?
Yes. Absolutely. And, yes.
And because we all like different things, and
this is so important. Yes.
Yeah, this is so important. Yes. But, you know, like sometimes people, they say, oh, Franz, how do you think I'm doing with my practice? And they say, oh, you know, I can feel more. They might say, oh, I feel more heat in my hands, or I see a color. And I said, okay, all good and well. But I said, how are you in your daily life? Do you feel less angry, less worried, less fearful? Do you feel more kind and compassionate?
Yeah.
I said, that is really the measuring stick of, for me, the system of Reiki.
Right. Yes, I did tell a student that the other day that I would be able to tell.
Yeah, good.
Based on what they were coming back to me with. And it's true, in their daily life. You know, Reiki provides this sort of these foundational tools. And yeah, if you put them into practice, then, you know, they will bring results. You know, let's talk mantras though, because that is something that I feel like so my teacher took the Asui 1, 2, and 3, and I think pretty much went with what her teacher taught us. And then she added a separate Japanese Reiki section. And in there, you know, we did different breathing techniques.
Mm-hmm.
The three keys being the one that I remember the most. And then there was some sort of orbital breathing that she taught us. But then the mantras, we learned them, but they weren't pushed as like something that we should probably consider doing on a regular basis. And then same with the chanting. So she taught us the chanting just with the symbols, with the way we pronounce them. So shokore, shokore, shokore. Mm. And then she did try and bring in the other one, which is more like a vowel sound.
Yeah.
Which I think that when I listen to your videos, I think that's more in line with what you do.
Mm-hmm.
than the other way. But again, back to like the way we learn individually, like is there a problem with just chanting the way that you like originally learned?
I mean, you know, like,
would it resonate after a while? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I mean, like, for example, let's look at Chokore.
Yes.
So there were two different ways of working with that, like Chokore, the mantra, yes. Or the mantra O-U-A-E.
Yeah.
And as you can see, the O-U-A-E sounds are in Chokore. So it's kind of in there. And, of course, we can debate till we're blue in the face and say... It's like the chicken and the egg, you
right,
know.
Right.
Was Chokore first or OAE first?
Right.
Now, what I see in our classes is that when people work with the vowel sound in OAE, that has a very direct experience, a very kind of almost like a quick direct experience. And I think that comes because if you look at all spiritual practices – in the world, you know, these particular sounds of O, U, A, E, sometimes there's also an I in it, but let's not get distracted. we see that in a lot of spiritual teachings, even, you know, like Yahweh, you know, like in as the name of God, we see all of these things are so common. And you know, like in Japan, these five sounds of A, O, U, A, E represents the five elements. And they say it's the five mother sounds of Japanese language, what is really pure sound. So by saying this, we really connect to this inner essence of ourselves. And these kind of practices have been practiced in Japan since, I don't know, maybe 6th, 7th century, you know, for a long, long, long time.
Right.
So, but then over time, when you really start to chant, say if you just chant O-U-A-E for a long time, and I'm not saying, you know, 1 week, you talk about a couple of years, then there will come a time where there is no difference between chanting Chokure or O-U-A-E. It's exactly the same.
Okay.
And... but yeah, I see for most students that O-U-A-E chanting is much more direct. But again, it's not just the chanting, you know, because we also have to make sure that we do it correctly. And what I mean by that is this. I was at a conference in New Zealand and I gave a direct example. And I said, you know, and actually used Chokore. And I said, we can just sit here and go, Chokore, 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 and, you know, look at my phone. Think about dinner tonight.
Right.
I don't know. But then we're all distracted. The chanting goes nowhere because we're so distracted. Or we can really rest our mind on the hara, the dantian, and being in this really quiet space and then do the chanting. Then there is a very different ramification. So I normally explain this in a class. You know when you have a singing bowl?
Yes.
And you hit it, you hit it once, but you can hear the vibration.
Yeah.
Right? So I ask people, I hit it, and they hear the vibration. I said, why can we hear the vibration? And they say, yeah, because you hit it. I said, no, it's not because I hit it. And why not? And so then I put something soft in the bowl and I hit it again and said, now you don't hear it, right? So it's not because I'm hitting it. So they go, oh, because it's empty. I say, yeah, because it's empty. So empty of what? Empty of rubbish. Sorry. So when we do the chanting, we have to be empty. And we have to be empty of any worry or fear or anger or any idea of an outcome. Then that vibration will trigger much more healing in our own being. And so therefore, it's not just chanting, but it's chanting and being in that open emptiness space.
So it's setting up, say, you know, creating a sacred space to have your meditation, You know, yeah. Set your intention.
That's it, yeah. All right. And in a way, I mean, this is the same when we do really hands-on healing, right? If we do hands-on healing with all sorts of attachments and worries and fear and being angry, then the impact will be less than if we go let go of all of that.
Right. And welcome in, you know, just, yeah, create a container that is free from, like you said, rubbish. The gunky stuff.
That's it. Yeah.
You know, so when you're, you know, for our listeners then, and you know, I don't know. I don't want them to think I keep saying the same things over and over and over again, but really, you know, in a way it's true. It's like, right, what is your established meditation practice going to be like? I mean, and do you recommend that your students do the meditation with the mantras every day?
Yeah, for example, if they've done Reiki 2, I really suggest that, first of all, I suggest working with the first mantra, Chokarei. But some people are not very auditory, so some people are more visual. So then I say, it's up to you. You can either do the visual, you know, the symbol, and then if you want, you can say the mantra 3 times. Or if you feel more auditory inclined, do just the mantra. And then it also depends. If I'm in a plane, I'm not going to chant out loud, right?
Right.
So then I might use temporary.
I don't know, the acoustics might be kind of cool.
Might be fun. So I can either do it quietly in my mind, or I can say, well, for today, I do a visual concept. Or maybe I have, like now, I have a bit of a funny throat. Then I might say, oh, instead of chanting, I work with the visual aid. So, you know, we all learn in different ways, and this is really important that we can see very, very clearly in Miku Sui's teachings that he was supplying different aids for different kind of people who learned in different kind of ways, auditory, visual, kinesthetic, intellectual. Yeah. They're all in there.
Right.
And so for the Reiki 2 student, I say, okay, go home. If you like the chanting, start small with 5 or 10 minutes and chant for 5 to 10 minutes Chokarei.
Cool.
And then do that for every day as much as possible, and do that for 6 months or a year, you know?
Yeah.
Because we can, you know, we can again debate until we're blue in the face what the symbol and mantras are about,
right?
I can read a book written by Carmen Tracy about Chokarei.
Right.
And then I might say, oh, now I know really what it is all about. But that's not true, because then I know what you're thinking it is about.
Yes.
Or I can do some research in Japan and go like, oh, it's used like this there and used like that there. It's also, yeah, I know something. But the only way of really knowing it is becoming it, becoming the symbol or becoming the mantra. And by doing that, is doing it again and again and again and again and again and again.
right.
And then we go like, oh, you know. But I had a big discussion with existing Reiki teachers quite a few years ago. And he said, Franz, how do you know what you're saying about this mantra? And I said, okay, if you want to know if I'm speaking the truth or not, go and do it 30 minutes once a day for 6 months.
Yeah.
And the teacher goes, I don't have time for that. I said, well, then don't, you know, then you cannot say this or that. I mean, you have to have that direct experience.
Right.
And when we have that direct experience, then something else comes in our way. And for me, that is like a hidden in the precepts, and it is faith.
Right.
That we have such a direct experience that we have faith in the symbols and mantras. We have faith that what we saying about it or about Miku Sui's teachings, that we go, oh, yes, because it comes from your own direct experience, not what someone has told you or not what someone has written, but really from your own direct experience. But this direct experience needs to be full. So, for example, I can go and eat a Thai meal and I say, oh, there's coconut milk in it, so this meal is just coconut milk. But that's not true, because there's other stuff in it, right?
Right, right.
So we have to eat it again. We have to pull it apart. We have to really investigate until we know completely what it is. And then we can say, this is it.
Wow. That's really cool. I think it's really exciting. This is an exciting time. I get more and more and more people coming into my space that are looking to, you know, start their journey on their Reiki path, you know, and I do get a fair amount of people that are looking to kind of leapfrog a lot of the practice and go right to working with other people.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, I don't know, I kind of feel like they're there and they're coming forward. And so somehow something, you know, something needs to be provided for them that offers, you know, more of the opportunity to establish an actual practice. Because if, you know, I think I have done this before where people will come in and be, you know, they'll say, oh, I'm Reiki 2 and, you know, I don't practice on myself.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, oh, okay, that's cool for you. I actually practice on myself every day.
Yeah.
It actually, it's made a big difference in my life, you know, and so.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I think, I guess I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with this, except that I get the sense that you would encourage like an openness and offering opportunity, and hopefully some of those opportunities like connect with those people versus just being like, you know, and from coming from a judgment space and being like, oh, you know, you can't necessarily call yourself a Reiki person if you're not practicing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there always need to be an openness. I'll give you one example. I've recently been in contact with someone who did a lot of training in Mrs. Takada's teachings. Hmm. And he's been doing that for a long, long, long time. I said, oh, I feel over the years there's something missing. I don't know this person. We've just been communicating by email. Yeah. And he said, I don't at this moment have time and money to do a classes. And I said, well, you know, just start contemplating the precepts and maybe – He really liked the kanji of Reiki, and I said, contemplate the kanji of Reiki. And I just got an email from him this morning, and he said, wow, this is really changing how I see Reiki. He said, I feel so much more open. He said, I feel so much more energy going through my body. He said, I feel so much more healing taking place when I help other people. He said, I wish I had done this earlier. I said, you know, it doesn't matter if we do it now or whatever age we are.
Right.
But he was ready because he had done previous practices. And he said, oh, yeah, there is something what I feel lacking, or there's something for me. And it's not for everybody, you know. But for him, he felt something needed to open up more. And therefore, you know, for me, I think it's really not, as you say, not judging or labeling, is just giving like a smorgasbord, you know, of teachings to the people and say, you take it, take, you want a visual or auditory or kinesthetic or another kind of practice. Ultimately, again, most important is that ultimately we become kinder human beings.
Right? It's
not about I'm in this lineage, or it's not about, oh, I study with this teacher, or it's not about I'm a closer to Miku Sui's lineage, you know, like, no, it is about becoming a better human being.
Yeah.
And that is the most important thing. And for me, this is really what Miku Sui was teaching, because if you look at the precepts, do not anger, do not worry, be grateful, practice diligently, but that can also be translated slightly different, more as like, be true to your way or pure experience, and show compassion to yourself and others. If you look at them, none of them is saying, feel energy, see colors, feel tingling in your hands or hot. And actually, all of them are a state of mind. It's a state of mind of not being angry, a state of mind of not being worried, a state of mind of being grateful, a state of mind of coming from your pure experience, and a state of mind of being compassion. And And therefore, for me, really, Miku Sui was saying with the precepts, it's all really about that we become a human being where we have less angry, less worry, less fear, and therefore we can become more grateful and more compassionate. And therefore, that is already healing.
Right, right. So, you know, with the, I forgot where I was going with that one question. I had this sudden vision, but then I was like, wait a second, that's not part of this conversation about, well, I guess it kind of was, because it was like, this kinder, gentlerness, right? That we are becoming, coming into contact with, because that comes out our eyes when we're out in public, because we're going to look at people nicer, and, you know, in our heart, we're going to like, you know, I really got that sense of how, Esui, would have, felt that going out when he was in community, because that is very healing to other people that we come into contact with.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's necessarily something you have. I mean, I don't know. Reiki One folks, it's not like that's not the point in doing it, right? It's really just to get into contact with yourself, your own inner healing, your own inner light, and really your true self.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's but imagine a lamp with lots of lampshades. If I am taking these lampshades away, and this light within that light is your inner great bright light, always symbolized by the Reiki 3 symbol and mantra, Daikomyo, great bright light. And what is really your Reiki or your true self, your inner nature, whatever we call it. And if I start to peel those layers away of this lampshade, then what happens to the light? The light starts to go further inside the room, right?
Yeah.
And this is what, so therefore, that healing is almost a byproduct of you opening up to your inner bright light. And the more you peel away those layers, therefore, the more that light will come forward, and then people can walk into your light. And what is that light? It is the light of no anger, no worry, no fear, and being kind. Right. And that, as you say, that is already so healing. You know, if you feel tired and depleted and you walk in the street and someone walks by and looks you in the eyes and gives you a smile, that's already uplifting. You feel already better.
Right.
Or you're standing in line somewhere and someone says, hey, you're okay? Or, well, you're wearing a nice top? Or can I do something for you? It's already healing. You know, we think healing is just hands-on healing, but no, healing comes from our heart. And the extension is just our hands, but really it's our whole being, our whole body, what can emanate this healing energy.
Right. Well, and I got such a sense of how impactful the mantras could be to boost that the process of like pulling away the lampshades, because, you know, sound has such a vibration and it can reach so deeply that I really got that picture of like, especially if you were chanting Daikomyo, right? Then that light would just start. It could just start spreading out farther and farther.
That'd be kind of cool. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, if somebody hasn't, so like myself, you know, I haven't added the mantras into like a regular practice. I started trying to experiment with them in my Reiki attunements, even though that's, you know, that detract like that. Was different than the way that I was taught. I was kind of called to add some for like particular students. But, you know, it sounds like I could, should I just start with one symbol or can I start with like a bunch of them, or is it better just to start with?
I would start with one, and I would really, you know, like in Reiki One, traditionally you were first taught the first mantra or symbol, what Chokurei. And that was really the first one, because if you actually investigate with the sounds of Cho, Ku, Re, from a traditional Koto Dharma viewpoint, then those sounds are really about grounding and centering.
Okay.
And we see this already also at the symbol, if you look at the symbol, it goes inwards, right?
Yeah.
And it's bringing us back home inside our body. And this is so important because we have to embody Reiki. We have to embody spirituality. It's not somewhere, something outside of there. And therefore, the grounding is so important and the centering, because then when we start to work with the other mantras, then the grounding and centering is like the foundation where we can build and have the other mantras rest upon, if that makes sense.
Sure.
They're kind of,
okay.
Chokurei is like the roots of your tree. And if the tree doesn't have a really strong roots and starts to go up and open up more to the heaven, but there is no roots and some external wind comes along, like maybe your husband or wife says something or society does something, then we fall over, right?
Right.
And so then when we fall over, we're going to have trouble. So therefore, the first point of call is always making a very solid foundation. And that's really what Chokurei is about.
Cool. Okay. All right. And then, so I really like the elements, the sound. So the sound, the main, what did you call them? Syllables, or were those vowel sounds?
I mean, this is another interesting aspect, because when you look at the other mantras, then there is also like the word ki in it, or aze or ae. So it depends on the mantra, and it depends also what they were trying to facilitate with inside of you.
Okay. I think I have a book that has like the vowel sounds. So, because you said there were five main.
Yeah, traditionally in Japanese spiritual practices, you have the five main vowel sounds. They call it the Koto Tama theory, and it's A O U A E. And if you for example look at the precepts in Japanese, Kyo da ke wa I karuna shinpai suna. All of these, you can really see those R-O-U-A-E sounds really clearly. And so even chanting the precepts, Kyo dake wa I karuna shinpai suna, etc., then we're really connecting to those five elements within ourselves, harmonizing them so that we can really connect to this connect more and more to our true self. So therefore that inner great bright light starts to emanate more and more to our whole being, and therefore benefit other people, and therefore we embody the precepts more and more.
All right. I'm excited to start.
So even you know, like, this is another thing, like in the precepts it says, oh, recite or chant with your mouth and heart, you know, but in a way it also means like hold the precepts in your heart. And so for me, it's not really about, sometimes we might say, oh, I'm reciting it, and we go, and you know, really quickly. But actually, that is just kind of almost memorizing it, and you just recite it by heart, you know, but it's not in your heart. You know, it kind of just comes out of your mind. But when we actually sit still and again go into that really open emptiness space, Kyo dake wa I karuna shinpai suna kansha shite kyo hake me hito ni senjatsu ni. Then we get a very different vibration.
Yeah. Yeah, that felt really good. Well, I really it's funny that that I'm coming, you know, kind of back around in such a spiral back to the chanting, because I really love kirtans. I really love the Hindu chakra system, and, you know, all those seed syllables and vibrating the body, and love sound healing. And, you know, here I think I'm not looking at it as like, oh, you were missing out on this opportunity. I was looking at it more as like, you know, you've created this opportunity and space in your life to add it into your practice. So,
yeah,
I'm excited to see what will
I mean, this is also such a common thing in Japan. You know, if you go to Japan, oh, you see people chanting everywhere, you know, in their homes, in their private temples, at Shinto shrines, everywhere people do some chanting. And because it's such a powerful tool for healing.
Yes. In your sound healing workshops, do you, you know, are you using, are you just using the tones, or do you actually use bowls and gongs and like that kind of stuff as well, like instruments?
I normally just use our voices. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Hey, so yeah, because once you get all the those different vibrations in the same space, it becomes really powerful.
Yes, but also for me, I really see it that we always have our voice with us. We don't always have a crystal ball with us,
right,
or we cannot always carry it on our bag.
Right.
But we always carry our voice with us. So
yeah.
Sometimes when we use, not always, but sometimes when we use too many external implements, we start to rely on them, you know.
Sure.
And a while ago, someone was asking me this question, and she had all these rocks and crystals and other things with her. And
sure.
I said, yeah, it's nice, but if you walk on the street, you go out to a party, all nicely dressed, and your friend falls over, and what are you going to say? Oh, I don't have my stuff with me, so I can't do hands-on healing, or it's not going to be as powerful because I don't have my stuff with me.
Right.
Then we give our power away, you know?
Yeah.
As it's just about really realizing that traditionally the rock or the crystal or the bowl were tools to help us to realize that innate power. They were not, you know, like, they were really an aid for yourself, if that makes sense.
Yes. Well, you know, I thought your website was really cool. I know we need to start wrapping up our conversation. When our listeners go to the International House of Reiki, you have a way that they can tell you like what, or they can say what area they're from, because you have opportunities all over right now for
That's
people
it.
To participate in your courses and your workshops and things.
Yeah, absolutely. On our website, if you kind of go to the homepage, there is you see a little tag what says Australia or Asia, North America, United Kingdom, Europe, and you click on it, and then you get subtags what says courses, online courses, or events and retreats, and you can click on those. And then,
yeah, that's an impressive little database you have behind the scenes there.
Yeah, it's really good, actually. Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, that's actually we have a retreat coming up in September in Philadelphia. And we have a retreat coming up in California. So we do some 4-day Reiki retreats where we do a lot of those kind of things we talked about today, actually.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's really cool. And then do you wind up in San Francisco quite a bit? Or it looked like you had a couple things going on.
Yeah, I do, actually, because I fly in from Sydney to San Francisco is an easy entrance point.
Awesome.
So I do quite a few classes in Sydney or in San Francisco, actually in February, I'm doing there a Reiki 1 and a Reiki 2 class.
Awesome.
And I also do often Reiki 3 Shimpudan class there. But yeah, I teach in New York. I teach in Boston, Cincinnati, Los Angeles.
Excellent.
Et cetera.
All right. Well, hopefully our listeners will be able to connect with you, you know, somehow as things come together and you fly around the country.
Thank you, Carmen.
Thank you, faithful. Well, you know, again, thank you so much for sharing your time. Is there, you know, is there anything else that I didn't ask you that you want to make sure our listeners know about?
No, I mean, that's
about,
it was
thank
perfect.
You so much.
I love it.
Excellent. All right. Well, I really, really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, and have, it's early in your time, so have a nice rest of your day.
Okay. Thank you.
All
thanks.
Right, thank
bye-bye,
you.
Carmen.
Bye. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that you enjoyed the show. Please be sure to visit our website at www.ReikiAnswerLady.com. There you will find relevant blog posts, our podcast archives and show notes, as well as information on upcoming workshops. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter so you do not miss any of our podcast episodes, workshops, or blog posts. Reiki Answer Lady would not exist without you. Please continue to send us your questions and feedback. Thank you. Many blessings.